Athletes love pushing their limits, but intense training can cause serious imbalances. This is exactly what happened to me. My name is Christopher Kelly. When I first entered the world of competitive mountain biking, I became plagued by numerous chronic health issues. So I changed my diet, and I identified my key imbalances with advanced biomedical testing. Before long, I was feeling and competing better than ever. Now, I'm helping other athletes do the same. Welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly, and today I'm joined by not one, but two special guests in person in Berkeley, California. I've got Rob Wolf. Say hello, Rob.
Hello, Rob.
And Dr. Tommy Woods.
Hello.
Well, I am delighted to have you both here. Rob, we're going to talk about your keto masterclass. Very excited. I've done the course myself. Really, really enjoyed it. Perhaps the first place we should go is why. Tell me about your purpose for creating.
Before we jump to that, like, you guys at some point in this thing really need to do like a Darth Vader voice and say, where once I was the student, now I am the master. Because I don't even research anything anymore. I just wait for my Nourish Balance Thrive feed to basically populate my brain and update things. So just to get that out of the way.
And that's very kind of you. You know, I thought about doing a standard bio, and then I thought, oh no, I bet Rob doesn't like bios. And then I thought, well, maybe I should just say what Rob means to us as an entity. And I mean, the first thing you did for me was recover my health. And then the next thing you did was help me launch a business, helping other people recover their health. So,
and yeah, then you introduced us to.
That's right. Yeah.
Which basically, I just discovered that on, was it Ken Ford's
podcast? Yeah, on STEM Talk.
Yeah, STEM Talk. Yeah. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. So I'll go back to my original question that I rushed into. Was that, tell me about your purpose. So just to give people some more context, you already wrote an award-winning New York Times best-selling book on the paleo diet that still forms the foundation of our business, right? You can get people eating a minimally processed whole food diet, free of refined seed oils and refined carbohydrates and all that good stuff. You get amazing results. Then you went on to talk about hyperpalatability and optimal foraging strategy and all that. And that was all really good information as well. Why go down this different direction and start talking about very low ketogenic,
or is
very
it
low
a different
carbohydrate
direction?
Ketogenic diet?
Is it the same direction? Just
or very, very much the same direction. And you know, it's interesting, even though I'm known as the paleo diet, my first foray into ancestral eating was a ketogenic diet. And for me at that point in my life, it was a lifesaver. Like, I kind of delineate my life before that time and then after that time, because I can recall all of my childhood feeling like my head was stuffed with cotton, like everything was happening like a mile out away from me. I had little windows of time where I would have some mental clarity, but most of the time I had a between meal window of opportunity of maybe 2-2.5 hours, and that got less and less as I kind of shifted my diet towards higher and higher carb, more grains, more legumes. For me, it was a bad mix. But also, looking back now, I was trying to do a graduate program. I was in Seattle. I had not seen the sun in months. And so, you know, I was still in that mindset that sleep was for the dead. You know, I wore the sleep deprivation like a badge of honor. And so I had maybe 4 years of super bad sleep, a diet that really wasn't copacetic with my physiology on the best of terms. And I wasn't living in the best terms due to stress and photoperiod and all that type of stuff. So it just crippled me. So looking back now, had I moved to Costa Rica and adopted a vegan diet, I might have been able to navigate it a little bit. You know, I would bake on a sun and it would help the digestion. But for that environment, it really wasn't a good fit. And it was such a profound life-altering event for me. It really drove me to want to help other people. And that was right around the time that CrossFit started popping up online. And I got connected with those folks, co-founded the first and fourth CrossFit affiliate gyms in the world, and got to work with a ton of people. And this low-carb kind of ketogenic approach to things was fantastic for people that were metabolically broken, oftentimes a great reset for their gut. It proved not to be so great for glycolytically based athletes, and I broke many a person trying to. Yeah, shocker.
As long as you learn from it, that's okay.
Well, you know, but it was still, I had to wait for you guys to come back around and be like, yeah, that doesn't work. I'm like, okay, that really doesn't work. Like, there literally was no stone that I left unturned with that. I broke a lot of people, including myself. And so I think one of the lines in Wired to Eat, I think the chapter heading is actually ketosis, the best tool that your doctor will never talk about or something like that, you know? And so it's a phenomenal tool, grossly misunderstood, both in the people that are promulgating the ketogenic diet. Like, we have a kind of almost two camps. One camp is fat bomb city, like the only route to get into ketosis is huge amounts of fat, super low protein, avoid insulin like the plague. And then you have this other camp that's recommending, hey, maybe you should chase a whole foods based diet, allow protein to really satiate the individual so that we get a spontaneous caloric reduction. Yeah. And man, there's no overlap between those two Venn diagrams other than that they both claim to be heading into this ketosis kind of realm. And I saw a lot of need for a comprehensive yet concise treatment of this ketogenic approach, including at the very beginning of it, a triage process, which may say, hey, you may not be a good fit for a ketogenic diet, you know? And so even though it's the Keto Masterclass, part of what we do in the beginning is actually put people through a sorting mechanism, a little bit of an algorithm, which I have to give a hat tip to you guys. I started thinking more about those sorting mechanisms with the work that you've done.
And we were inspired, actually. I noticed you were using bucket.io software, and we were inspired in part by Ryan Levesque and his ask method, right? Yeah. It's like, how about this? You just ask people how they feel, you know?
Holy smokes. Yeah, instead of guessing, I don't know, maybe they need this, maybe they need that. So, and that was actually something that was interesting. We surveyed our readership, and keto was a huge topic of interest. And then there were kind of different flavors of where people fell down with it. Some people just didn't know how to do it. They were brand new to it and they were totally overwhelmed. Some people were, at the end of the day, there was no more day. Like, they had no more time to do this stuff. Yeah. So there was a time criticality piece. Another big piece was social interactions, like husband, spouse, coworkers, you know. People would stick to the program through the week, and then on the weekends, it was going out to the bars and everything went sideways, and then they would feel like they needed to just abandon ship. So we kind of delineated some different groups of people that we felt would benefit from some really good stewardship through this process. And then also I wanted to do the best treatment I could on both the scientific side, but also the kind of clinical implementation side. Like, when is a large amount of fat consumption appropriate? Mm. And when should we really focus on protein and fibrous veggies and, you know, almost like a protein sparing modified fast, you know, and try to navigate those different needs, because you guys know this all the time. You can't start with all the granular details, but if you don't throw some granular details out there, all of a sudden the big picture thing that you threw out there is chiseled in stone. It's become another set of commandments. And then there's a religion that's developed around
is this paleo?
It. You know? Paleo.
Is this
keto? Yeah. Oh, man. Everything. Yeah. So there were a lot of different reasons that kind of lit a fire under me to do this treatment. But a lot of it is that I just love these approaches to eating. Like, for me, again, it's been a lifesaver. I still kind of navigate around that ketogenic realm, interestingly, and you guys just shot me some papers recently, like Sami's
his blog post. I'll link
on
to this
eating.
In the show notes. This is a really interesting blog post. I think that maybe ketosis or ketogenic diets for athletes is a little bit misunderstood in the amount of carbs they're really
eating.
Holy
smokes, because he was eating upwards of 300 grams a day in this very demanding mountain bike.
It was the Cape Epic, so it's a 7-day mountain bike race in South Africa. So I mean, he's working, He really is working.
Right.
But still,
he would do a vigorous refeed and wake up the next morning and be at millimolar ketone levels. And so there's just so much stuff to unpack with that. But I really feel like these approaches to eating are vastly underutilized. But at the same time, there's a tendency to engrave them in stone, turn them into religion, lose one's mind about how you can tweak and modify this stuff. And maybe it's appropriate for you today. And maybe 6 months down the road, it's not. And being able to provide some guideposts for that so that if things change, you have a template to be able to go back and say, oh, okay, well, this indicates that maybe I need to up the carbs, or maybe I need to do some sort of a targeted approach or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm so glad you made it a video training course rather than another book. You know, I'm kind of tired of the book format. It feels like something from times gone by before we had the internet and video and all of that kind of stuff.
You know, it's funny. There was an old Beck album, right? As they started getting like some CDs that had like some video interface and stuff like that. And it was so cool because you had the music, but then you had all this kind of multimedia interactive element to it. Mm. And that thing really struck me. And it was like mid-90s or something this came out, and it was pretty avant-garde for the time. But I've thought about that because some people take in material from a written perspective, and sometimes it's just easier to articulate it because you really want to maintain like a concise flow of consciousness. And for some people, they can set up a teleprompter and just rattle that stuff off. I'm not really that great at doing that. So the written piece is nice on the one hand. And then some of the video modules are actually a little bit more free form. I have an outline. I have some slides to kind of keep me on track. But oftentimes, I get some pretty good ideas even in the process of doing that. So thank you. Like, I enjoyed that process so much more than just writing a book, even though time invested wise was probably comparable to doing both of my previous books. Yeah, it was a chunk of work. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So who's the course for? You know, we've got lots of people listening right now who are athletes, maybe practitioners, super users, people who are really technical. And I'm wondering whether this is a course for them, or did you have someone else in mind when you designed the course?
Honestly, what I geared this course for is the Weight Watchers crowd. Like, that was my goal, because I feel like those are the people who really need the most help. Like, that's where westernized society is going to implode if we don't change the vector on this diabetes kind of story. But that said, there are a lot of people that, again, maybe they have not figured out how to manage the time element of this. And like, we have some phenomenal resources on helping people manage their actual meal prep. Nikki came up with this system of making sauces, and she's actually thinking about doing some additional stuff with that. But she would make 5 or 6 sauces on the weekend, and then you cook your hunk of protein. And then on day one, you would have a pesto sauce. Day two, you have an aioli sauce. Day three, you have like a Mexican themed sauce. So even though you've got the same protein, on day one, you would eat it whole. On day two, you cut it into strips. On day three, you cube it. So you're getting both a palate and a sensory change. So kind of harkening back to Wired to Eat, we're getting enough variety in there that almost the same stuff is different enough that you're not like, oh my God, I'm going to hang myself. So the raw beginner is definitely a good person. People who are time crunched, it's definitely good. And then people who have run aground on that social piece, I actually provide a lot of kind of mindset type stuff for helping to navigate that. And I actually put together a couple of videos, which we haven't released those yet, but it's basically a conversation with the parent or the spouse or the significant other. It's like, hey, so somebody who cares about you wanted me to talk to you. You know, I'm Rob Wolf, New York Times bestselling author. My parents died young. You have a child who is concerned about your health. They don't want you to die young. And what they're asking you to do is try this for 30 days. But it's basically this attempt at offloading that social friction. So I become the virtual intermediary on that. So we've been working on that. I couldn't finish all that in the way that I wanted for the course, but that's going to be some bonus add-ons that we provide. So, you know, I'm really trying to tackle the people who have run aground in this scene. The high-level athlete, God bless them, they're great. And that's where it's awesome you guys are here because you guys can really help them. But for me, my passion is really the folks that might die young, that might not see their grandkids grow up and stuff like that. So a high-level athlete could certainly get some material out of this, but it's really not geared for them. If they do any coaching, it could be a phenomenal resource to recommend to coaching clients and stuff like that. Yeah.
So maybe I could ask the listeners then, if you know someone who might benefit from this type of course, then perhaps you are the person to, don't shove it in their face, but just maybe nudge them into the direction of contemplation, so we say.
Right. We've been doing some pretty good videos. Like, I did a breakdown on the difference between paleo and keto.
Right.
And it's pretty solid. It's like an 11-minute video piece, and the response has been great to that. And it's all like a lead-in for promoting the Keto Masterclass.
Was that background Photoshop, by the way? I saw the video. I thought it's really interesting. I wanted you to talk about this because it's a demonstration, it's an example of the tremendous resistance you get from people when you're exposed to enough of them. Wasn't that incredible? What do you tell me about the was that background Photoshopped question?
It was hilarious. This woman who I'm sure is just absolutely wonderful, and in some ways I feel like a jerk, but she said, I just couldn't pay attention to what he was saying. The background was fake. Is it a brick background in a building? Why do you, how did she wrap it up?
Why would you distract us with this?
Why the deception?
Oh, the
deception. You know, and I wrote back to her, I'm like, are you serious? Those are the Sierra Nevada mountains. Like, and then I put in another photo from a different angle with my kids, but you could see the mountains and everything. I took out her name, but then posted the comment on my private Facebook page, and everybody savaged the person. And then it turned out she's like this retired woman, and the picture she has in her profile is of her now deceased war hero husband and everything. Oh, she's like, oh, I'm really sorry. That totally makes sense. I thought there was a cow in the background. What she thought was a cow was our goat house and everything. So then I basically wanted to go hang myself because I'm like, I'm such a dick, you know, but yeah. But it was interesting that clearly, and she said, well, I'm really interested in this stuff. But the potential that there was like a fake background or something like just spun her out. And it's funny, like if you get a large enough population size, you get the most wacky responses. Like you just would never in a million years predict that people are going to go the direction that they go. And it's really interesting. It's kind of crazy, but yeah.
We saw a little bit with our analysis, you know, our machine learning analysis, and we paid to do some Facebook advertising. And so we put that whiteboard explainer video in front of maybe a million people. And some of the comments, I just couldn't believe it. It was not like our normal comments at all, you know.
Right.
Intelligent, well-referenced, great questions, really wonderful people who were very kind and happy. It was just like, oh, this is black magic. This is witchcraft. There's no way this could work. And I'm thinking, yes, it can.
People who just like one word, bullshit. It's like, that's fine. You come here. I will send you the science. I'll send you thousands of words if you want. But no. Just happy to turn up and call bullshit because... Well, that's what people do when they're at that kind of level of social interaction.
It's easy to do when you're sat behind a screen.
Facebook effect.
It hurts when you go from the well-curated group of people you're used to hanging out with,
exactly.
And then you end up
wild.
In the YouTube commentary kind of
comments.
Holy smokes, man. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is that something that you're sort of gearing yourself up to see more of? And you just kind of hope that enough of the message is good that it will help enough people, which I'm sure is... probably the case.
Oh yeah, I already had a couple of kind of keto critique groups like totally savaging me because I'm playing around with some Facebook marketing, and so we're doing some kind of canned ad copy. We're playing around with the videos where I have a topical piece, and man, they just... So what was funny is this one group, their reason for being is criticizing the nuttery that occurs in the keto scene.
Yeah.
So
I think I know who you mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so the two things that they seem to be critical of is that keto is appropriate for everybody, and then the fat bomb to nirvana kind of deal. And so it's interesting. They were super critical of me. They were critical of Mark Sisson. They're like, yeah, you guys are just jumping on the bandwagon. You're trying to take this stuff, repackage it, and just explain to them how to exercise and eat in an intelligent fashion. And I'm kind of like, and your issue with that is what exactly? Yeah. Like, I'm just kind of like, okay, so your reason for being is you want people to not portray keto in the way that it's being portrayed. These other folks are not portraying it that way, but it's not. It's kind of like almost if we solve their problem, then they're not going to have a reason for existing. Uh-huh. So it was interesting. I put on my, you guys know Mike Rowe, the Dirty Jobs guy.
Oh, no, I don't.
He's amazing. He's hilarious. He was the host of this show called Dirty Jobs, and he would go in and show like what garbage collectors do and horse inseminators. And I mean, and he's hilarious, but the guy never loses his cool, and he always comes out on top in the way that he treats this online nuttery. And so I kind of feel like I did instead of my usual like Viking Hulk smash kind of gig, I did the mic. Nikki's like, you got to micro this thing. And so I kind of micro'd it. And interestingly, then we got a bunch of sales out of that
wow,
group.
Wow.
So like,
that's phenomenal.
So another Darth Vader or Obi-Wan deal. Strike me down and I'll be more powerful than you can imagine. Yeah.
Tommy, who do you think the ketogenic diet is for? Like, who would you recommend? I mean, you get people come up to you all the time and say, what should I do to fix all my problems? To which people do you say, oh yeah, ketogenic diet would be a good option for you?
It's almost always somebody with some kind of metabolic disease, which is absolutely the crowd that you're catering for.
Right.
Which is also 2/3 of the population in which we live, essentially.
Right.
And I think that's where... at least using those principles, right? Chasing a certain keto number or anything like that, I think is generally going to lead you to craziness when that's actually not at all what you're trying to achieve. You're trying to achieve some kind of improvement in metabolic health. But anybody like that is kind of, that would always be my first go-to. And you have to, as Rob knows, you have to kind of sell it to the person from where they're at, right? So as soon as you go, if you just like say ketogenic diet, then, you know, for some people, they're going to immediately back off and say, exactly, you think about fat bombs and all this other kind of craziness, or they think about ketoacidosis, which is a whole other bag of tricks. But just sort of changing the dietary plane such that you're removing all that crap that essentially got them in trouble is essentially what you're doing, right? And then that just gives their body a chance to heal. But then, you know, the question, and I think this is very suitable for you, Rob, as you expand this to hopefully hundreds of thousands, millions of people, right? That's the goal. And we certainly hope we can get to that point. Where is it required and where is it no longer required? Like, how do you get to the point where some people would call it an intensive or severe intervention, which, depending on how you look at it, it may or may not be.
So is multiple amputation.
Yeah.
So.
No, absolutely, right? So you can get to that point and, you know, people will sustain themselves on the diet forever and they'll feel great. But when the way that I think about it is that if any intervention, you should get somebody to a point where they can then eat carbohydrates again, or you can go back to something that's
more latitude.
Yeah, exactly. However you want to describe it. So say somebody gets into it, how do they then figure out when they've had enough? When have they achieved what they wanted to achieve? Is there any metric, or do you go by feel? How do you kind of navigate that?
Yeah, it's largely chicken entrails and tea leaves right now. But I have a few thoughts on that. Generally, if we get someone down to a reasonable degree of leanness, usually some good things have happened, although not everybody who's metabolically broken is overweight. Oh, yeah. So that's a whole confounder. But generally, some degree of leanness is a pretty good starting point. I do think that inexpensive and short suite of testing, like an LPIR score, maybe something like a CRAFT test or something like that, like really kind of establishing a little bit of that metabolic health. So we have an objective element of that. And then on somewhat more subjective, although there's a little objectivity to it, is doing something like the 7-day carb test, like finding some carbs, reintroducing them, having a process whereby you would transition from a basic ketogenic diet to a modest carbohydrate diet to set yourself up for some success on that. And we have two pieces to that. We have the actual blood glucose numbers, and then we have kind of how do you feel?
Yeah.
I have good cognition, my digestion is good, and then we can figure out a way or a spot that we can introduce some greater latitude with that. And if we can encourage people to then do some things that I think are a lot easier, like just eating while the sun is up, trying to get outside and get some sun on their skin, there's a bunch of these other palliative elements that, so long as we can stop the house from burning down and we can kind of turn that direction, 4 months, 6 months down the road, they will probably have a lot more latitude with what they can do. And because they've had this success, when we tell them, hey man, like 5 days out of seven, don't eat or drink anything after sunset. Yeah. In the summer, you got more latitude. In the winter, you have way less latitude, particularly if you live at more northern or southern extremes. Exactly. I think for a lot of people, they're kind of like, okay, I can do that because it's not such a constraining process. So I do think we need some biometric kind of milestones so that we have a little objectivity with it. It needs to be inexpensive. It needs to be easy to track. But I think there's enough individual variability that then relying on how do you feel and just some simple things, what you guys largely do with
the subjective questions.
Yeah, I mean, how's your sleep? How's your digestion? What's the libido doing? And man, you learn so much from that, particularly if you have the 1,000 data points of correlative data on the back end like you guys do. But I think that that's a really good spot to be. And then within that population, there will be some people that they're probably going to eat keto-ish the rest of their lives. And it's going to be a great fit. We've even got some of these folks that are doing the fully carnivore thing. And by all accounts, they're crushing it. And it is, those people do not do that because they want to be in the cool carnivore crowd. It's because they were crippled before. And this is the one thing that keeps them comparatively healthy. And then we have this whole huge spectrum that expands out from there. But the challenge, I think, is always, it's almost like taking a microscope and zooming in and zooming out. How do we start with a big picture, broad brushstroke approach, get people moving in the right direction, and then provide the sorting to get them going where they specifically need to go?
So what about when people don't achieve the results that they're expecting? Have you thought about what steps they can take to figure out what it is that's holding them up? Because so when Chris hosted the Keto Summit, and I've given some talks at some low carb conferences, and a lot of people come up and they're like, I was really doing really well. I felt really good for X amount of time, but then my fasting insulin didn't come down, or my blood glucose kept going up, or I still didn't get my fertility back, or I didn't lose as much weight as I thought I would. So how do people start to navigate that and figure out what maybe they should be changing to kind of get those results?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in the course, we call it the dreaded plateau. And generally, we reference that to weight loss specifically. We really lean heavily on the work that the Keto Gains guys have done. Like, they're just so crackerjack at this stuff on that kind of systems implementation. But we really sleep, We refer back to sleep. When are you going to bed? What's the quality? What are you doing? Are you doing proper electrolytes for that? So, you know, the electrolyte piece ends up being really huge, encouraging people to go back through and recalculate their macronutrients and make sure that they're not overdoing it.
They're not leaving anything to chance.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think one of the cool things about low-carb and kind of ketogenic diets is it's reasonably easy to do them seat of the pants and not overeat.
Just throw away the bun, right? You're done.
Yeah.
Ketogenic diet.
And generally, that works pretty good, but people can overdo it. We had a client that I mentioned in my first book where the guy was losing a little bit of weight. He was over 400 pounds, but he wasn't like just lighting it up. And then I said, okay, just write down approximately what you're eating. And it was like breakfast, and then he had lunch, and then he had a snack, and the snack was almonds. And I'm like, how many almonds? And he said, well, you know, the Costco container of almonds. And so he would sit down and eat 3,500 calories of almonds in a sitting. And I'm like, the fact he was losing any weight was kind of a miracle, you know? Yeah. And so reorienting people on making sure their macros and the total caloric load is within reasonable boundaries. Calories matter. Food quality matters. And the way that we are able to reduce our caloric intake spontaneously is by having good quality food. And so it becomes kind of a virtuous cycle and this crazy the amount of pissing matches around this stuff, you know, and people would want to burn me at the stake for even saying that. And then finally, having reasonable expectations also. Sometimes people get in, and there are great examples of people who were maybe sarcopenic and overweight, and then they start lifting weights and they increase their protein intake, and they're just looking at the scale. And even though they've gone down, you know, like there are some amazing pictures of women in particular, like 80 kilo woman, 52 kilo woman, and the 80 kilo one looked amazing.
Yeah.
Because she's put on a ton of muscle mass and like she's now got some curves and everything. And yet she's a lot heavier. And some people are like, well, they're so freaked out on just the scale number that it's literally like this kind of mystical religious kind of thing. Like you couldn't have a conversation with them around that. But those are kind of the things where I would address on the plateau. And we do mention like part of the sorting process is asking, do you have any known or suspected thyroid or adrenal issues? Are you a glycolytic based athlete like CrossFit Games, MMA, those sorts of things, pregnant or breastfeeding woman? And usually in those situations, we recommend against generally a specifically like ketogenic diet. We recommend starting somewhere around that 75 to 100 grams of carbs, using that same macronutrient calculator to establish caloric load, make sure you're getting adequate protein, and then trying to get the bulk of those calories from low glycemic load vegetables and then the appropriate fat level. So this is, again, where even though it's the Keto Masterclass, we don't necessarily sort everybody into a classically ketogenic diet.
You think about all those people that we've seen, Tommy, who have been under-eating on a ketogenic diet, and if they'd done the macro calculator and had some rough idea of how many calories they need, that problem may never have happened in the first place.
The only problem, I think, with the macro calculators is, as an endurance athlete, when you're just spending so many hours out on the road, how do you calculate
that?
How do you adjust that? I think that's the only trick there. But, I mean, it's absolutely true that when people like ask me, what's the main issue you see with nutrition in your athletes? It's like, they're just not eating enough.
Right.
They've listened to the low carb guys. They've listened to the anti-protein guys. They've listened to the fasting guys, and they're doing all of it and training 20 hours a week. And it's a disaster.
Right.
But like you say, if you used a macro calculator,
it seems so dumb. The first time I see one, I'm like, you don't know how many calories are in food. Like, I don't believe you know how many calories you would spend when you exercise. This is completely meaningless. Like, why would anyone ever bother do this? And then you meet the people that didn't do it, and you're like, oh, okay, that's good.
Well, I forget who I had on my show, but she was talking about how easy it is to undereat when you're lower carb, and I was kind of noodling, and I'm like, man, I have been kind of cold lately.
You know? I mean, and we've made a cottage industry out of it. I'm telling you.
Oh, geez, you know, and I tracked for 3 or 4 days, and I was maybe like 1,200 calories. Yeah. I just wasn't hungry. And that's actually a spot where I started reintroducing more carbs just so I had enough appetite to want to eat. Yeah.
I really want to save people from this. I've got to get some more people that we've worked with on the podcast to talk about this, because it's this magic elixir. You know, people think, oh, it must be the, to give you one recent example, Doc Parsley's sleep remedy, which we've had fantastic results with, but it ain't as good as eating enough food if you're deprived of calories, right?
Shocker.
And people are like, oh, it must be some supplement you sent me. No, it was the recommendation to eat more food. We've really seen this mess a lot of people up now at this stage. And it's, you know, sometimes you'll see You know, so Verta have published some articles about thyroid function and how they think the changes in thyroid function are maybe not as important as anyone makes out. But in the testing that we do, we're seeing downstream effects of what looks like hyperthyroidism, right? So somebody with a mean corpuscular volume at 99, yeah, and they're not clearing cortisol, and their testosterone is in
their
base.
And their LDL is high. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you worry about people doing the diet as symptom control, right? So you've got some underlying pathology that you need to take care of, and sure, you feel better on the diet, but really you're just still managing symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, and I could be blindsiding myself so focusing on the kind of diabesity story, but that seems so huge right now. And if we can get any type of movement towards just kind of some appetite management, carb awareness, you know, carb intolerance, it seems like a net win. But, you know, again, we've got this problem. And then to your point, what other collateral problems are we dealing or creating in trying to deal with this first problem of, say, like diabetes and overeating? Yeah, I am concerned about that. And that's where, to the best of my ability, without making this thing super complex, we try to provide these kind of, we actually have built into the program these weekly and then quarterly self-checks, sleep, fertility, how do you feel tolerating hot and cold and all that type of stuff, so that hopefully we can kind of head that stuff off so that we're addressing these big challenges of kind of metabolic syndrome and everything that goes along with that, but then not creating, like you said, the cottage industry of all these people with thyroid dysregulation and hypogonadism.
You cure diabetes in 200 million people, then you make a new course that cures whatever the next problem is.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, I think Warren Buffett is the largest owner of dialysis centers in the world, and he's like a principal stakeholder in Coca-Cola. So it's like horizontal and vertical integration of the whole process. And maybe we just do that. So we shut down the diabetes clinics and then we open up tons of functional medicine clinics and we get everybody on HRT.
Perfect.
Yeah. I thought you were going to tell me that he'd mitigated his risk by going long and short, right? So he's got shares in Coca-Cola and Verta Health at the same time.
Oh, you should
do
that
too. I don't think they've done that yet. But yeah.
All right, well, let's go down this direction. Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit of name dropping right now because it was a rare opportunity for me. So I had breakfast with Steve Finney.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the other day I got invited down to the Verta offsite. Jim McCarter was kind enough to invite me down. I got to have breakfast with Steve Finney. And we were talking about the length of time that it takes to keto adapt. And that's why so many of these studies in exercise science are flawed, is that they didn't give enough time for these athletes to adapt. And I said to Steve, it took me 2 years to get back most of my exercise performance. And he said, yeah, that's because you're not eating enough salt.
Oh, really?
And I suddenly realized, you know, you think that some of this stuff is so trivial.
Right.
Like what I just said, just throw away the bun. You're done, right? That's it. That's a ketogenic diet. And you could say the same thing with the salt. Like, if only I'd done the training course, I probably would have saved at least 12 months, maybe even more. So can you talk a bit about maybe the importance of electrolytes and anything else, any other gotchas that you've seen?
Oh, man. Yeah. You know, the electrolyte thing was interesting. And this is funny because when Paleoland, so like Lauren Cordain is very much against sodium intake. And he's got a position around this. It's interesting because clearly I'm a big fan of the evolutionary biology framework, but like, the only place you could, that is hypothesis generation. And then we get out and we start testing. You can test on a clinical level, that's fine. But it was always interesting to me early on because we had these epidemiological studies that showed this really fascinating U-curve with sodium intake. And it was very steep morbidity and mortality on the too low sodium intake. Like, it was really nasty. And then you ended up at a low ebb of morbidity and mortality at 8 grams of sodium intake a day, which is nearly like 16 grams of like table salt. And then the trailing edge where morbidity and mortality increased was really flat. And you got out to like 20, 25 grams before the thing really started goosing up. And again, that's 25 grams of sodium. So you're talking about 50 grams of table salt, basically, to get that, or some other form. So that was something always in the back of my head that I was kind of like, huh, that's interesting, you know, compared to a lot of other recommendations that I think Lauren was very prescient about. But even on a clinical level, when I would recommend something that looked like kind of a paleo-type diet in our gym setting, once we hit things like, okay, no vinegar, which is something that Lauren recommended, and then no salt, people were like, screw this, I'm done. Like, I am done.
Because food doesn't taste of it.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, you know, if we're getting people generally off of wheat, because a lot of people are gluten intolerant, then salt's a negotiation spot. So for me, I think I was coming from the spot where I was almost trying to like avoid slings and arrows out of the kind of classic paleo camp, even though I felt like I was consuming quite a lot of sodium comparatively. Then I started really digging into the material that Finian Volek had originally published and really look at, okay, how much are they talking about? And then hanging out around the Keto Gains forums, those guys will do a 5 to 8 gram sodium bolus before they work out. And I was kind of like, okay. And then DeNicola Antinio's book came out and I had him on the podcast and I was chatting with him and he had some really interesting perspectives again on the evolutionary biology, like collecting the blood and all this type of stuff. I was like, okay. So I started really playing with that. I'm not even like specifically keto. I'm lower carb, 7,500, 150 grams a day. But before Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu sessions, I started doing, started off at 2 gram boluses. I would take 2 grams, mix it in a little bit of water and then do some additional water on top of it. And it was like I had infinite fuel tank. I just didn't bonk. Like I just went and went and the intensity was higher. People were like, what are you doing? It was multiple areas that helped educate me on this. But again, I have to give a real hat tip to the Keto Gains guys, Tyler and Luis. Like they've just been pretty steadfast in that. And this is one of their go-to positions if people are not getting the success that they should be getting. Where are your electrolytes at? And not like, oh, I had a little of this, a little of that. What did you weigh out? What did you consume? And they're recommending sodium, potassium, magnesium. They're also playing around with some recommendations around calcium, which we're kind of nervous about because it seems like every study that you look at where people supplement calcium, their cardiovascular risk deal is kind of an issue, but the ketogenic state may be different enough that maybe we need to give that some airplay. But, you know, it was part hitting a brick wall multiple times, part smarter people helping to inform me on this and just continuing to kind of pick at the edges of the story. But the electrolyte piece, and it's kind of funny because it's just salt. But you would think, is that really like the keys to the kingdom?
It's not sexy enough of a solution.
It's not sexy. Yeah, and it is huge. Even a lot of the sleep disturbances that people experience, if you consume adequate salt, then you suppress the aldosterone release, which also has kind of collateral stimulation of cortisol and epinephrine. And so a lot of folks that are experiencing sleep disturbances, if they get that sodium, potassium, magnesium story dialed in, all of a sudden they're sleeping great. And man, a penny solution for something that could really be derailing the whole process. Yeah.
Tommy, can you talk to some of the mechanisms there? Why would it be that you'd need more electrolytes, sodium in particular, on a ketogenic diet?
Well, I think the one that most people focus on is actually the mechanisms of retention of sodium, which are driven by glucose and insulin through different mechanisms. But basically, as those come down, you just retain less of it. So you're peeing out more, essentially, and then you just need more to maintain balance. So that's kind of there's some really interesting papers on how insulin regulates electrolyte reabsorption in the kidney, for instance. And so as your insulin drops because your carbohydrate load drops, then you might need more just to sort of maintain the same levels.
And how does this fit into the ancestral health framework, right? So we've all said, oh, well, yeah, the reason you can enter this turbo mode ketosis thing is so that you can survive periods of not having much food. How does that fit in with evolutionary health? You've had like some giant salt lick that you had access to in times of scarcity.
I actually don't know. That's a good question.
I think it paints a picture that although I think ketosis was a constant companion of humanity, it was not a consistent state. So due to exercise and comparative food scarcity, I think we kind of went in and out of it. And that transition was probably pretty seamless. I don't think people were hitting the low carb flu. I did some experiments between my wife and I. She's very insulin sensitive, handles carbs fine. And then she transitioned straight into ketosis and has no problems. I mean, she just no difference cognitively, no difference on her performance, doing athletic stuff. And I think that that should be kind of the human norm. But if we have some mitochondrial issues, some other problems, and that could be something that's stymieing that. But I think it really, Chris Masterjohn did a really great treatment of this where he makes the case that there are many laudable recommendations for the ketogenic diet, but really trying to paint a picture that it is the default ancestral metabolic state is really hard to do. There's so many reasons that it just doesn't seem to pass the sniff test. But again, I think that it was woven into the framework of our day-to-day existence and we went in and out of it all the time. And then if we were potentially getting higher sodium intake from things like interstitial fluid and blood and, you know, different products like that, then maybe that's where we kind of puff some of that up. It's interesting. And I don't know if you guys have had Chris Masterjohn on the show yet, but
we have.
Yeah.
But I think part of it, probably the issues when you talk about the struggles of keto adaptation, it probably speaks exactly to how abnormal the diet was from before. So if you're talking about the ancestral framework, you're so far away from how we would have been previously that change to ketosis isn't seamless anymore because it's such a big gap.
It's a huge drop in insulin. Yeah,
it's a huge physiological gap. And then maybe that's where the struggles come from, not because it was something that wasn't part of the framework of what we should be able to do, but just because we've treated our bodies in a way that they're not supposed to be treated, then it suddenly becomes a big issue when you're trying to achieve it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
What other gotchas have you seen?
Around ketosis. Definitely the fat bomb thing.
Yeah, talk about the ways to enter ketosis, because then the fat bombs sort of fit into that.
Yeah, Ted Neiman has a great kind of infographic on this where it's eat nothing, enter ketosis, eat low carb, enter ketosis, eat high protein and not much else, enter ketosis, eat a super high carb diet and exercise like somebody's trying to kill you, and you enter ketosis. So there's all these different kind of paths into that. And something that is often forgotten is that the ketogenic diet was developed as a starvation mimetic in response to seeing benefits for epileptics and potentially some other neurodegenerative conditions. And so we saw that these people entered ketosis effectively during starvation periods. We know that that's kind of the fastest, that really is the fastest way to enter ketosis, like starvation plus exercise, because you're providing no additional substrates. Mm. So even the fat bomb, people will argue that that gets you into ketosis faster.
Which just cannot be correct.
It can't be because you're providing triglyceride as a backbone, and that can feed into repleting glycogen status and whatnot. And so, I mean, really the fastest way to get into ketosis, I don't know if anybody's done this study, but, you know, it's like starve people and exercise them at high intensity, exercise them to exhaustion, and you're going to get somebody ketotic quickly and pretty profoundly. I think one thing that's happening in that fat bomb story, though, so I don't want to fully throw it under the bus, is that when people have a disordered appetite control mechanism, they don't know when off actually occurs. And so allowing them to eat a lot of food and feel fully satiated, there's not that kind of panicked experience of hormonally driven hunger. And you may think that this one's kind of far afield, but when my wife was pregnant and we were kind of learning about Pitocin and everything, and we pretty well understood. So Pitocin can be released naturally to facilitate all the birthing process and whatnot. But if a woman is given a dose of Pitocin, it's a super physiological level, and the severity of the pain she experiences makes it impossible to go without some sort of exogenous pain relief. And so in a somewhat similar way, and this is kind of what you alluded to a moment ago, what if the hunger that people are experiencing due to a disordered modern lifestyle is so terrible that it's something that we really have no ability to deal with from kind of an evolutionary basis? Like, it makes you crazy. You would kill somebody and eat them. And so in that way, the fat bomb may be beneficial in that it finally hits that satiety center where it's like, okay, you're okay. And then possibly over the course of time, the insulin resistance starts reversing. Possibly we even start getting some remodeling in the hypothalamus due to the presence of ketones, and there may be some hypothalamic damage that may get reversed over the course of time with elevated ketone levels and just generally not overeating. So maybe we're fixing some of that. So even though the fat bomb is kind of a gotcha, as usual, I'm in the spot where I end up managing to piss everybody off, where there may be an argument where some people, it's kind of like, okay, let's do that. Let's do that for a week. And then let's reevaluate and see how we're doing with everything, and then start focusing more on nutrient density and stuff like that. So it's, again, it could be a viable tool, but if your goal is reducing body weight and leaning out and reducing inflammation and whatnot, and you've just been like hammering bulletproof coffee and, you know, every manner of fat, and you're avoiding protein like crazy, and if we were to plug you into Marty Kendall's nutrient optimizer, like, we would need a private detective to find any valuable nutrition in this thing. There's probably a problem there, you know, and it would be reflected in the fact that you're probably not feeling good. You're not losing body fat. And we could probably track down some good markers of systemic inflammation in those people. So definitely the fat bomb thing is kind of a gotcha. And then I think the electrolytes are a big one. Sleep, as usual. just doing all the sleep hygiene stuff, like it just pays such huge dividends. But those are probably the biggest ones. I don't know if you guys have some other gotchas. I guess maybe the biggest other one is that the ketogenic or low-carb eating is super powerful in appetite suppression, and it's super easy for people to under-eat.
Right.
So that can be great in the beginning when we're trying to lose body fat. That can be disastrous down the long haul.
Yeah, so I think the process that you just described, like learning to understand when you're hungry and when you're not, and being able to control your appetite, that is the beginning of the road that leads to under-eating, specifically for athletes. I can't speak to other people with insulin-resistant type 2 diabetes, but certainly that's where it begins with the athletes that we've worked with. Is for the first time, they're feeling like they don't have to eat. You know,
right.
Like I'm doing 12 hours a week of exercise.
And it's so liberating.
Like, yeah. It is amazing. To carbs for years. Yeah. It's such an incredible feeling to like just be able to relax, enjoy your life without thinking about food all the time. And then you follow that to the nth degree. You're like, okay, so how little food, and we've seen this as well with the metabolic flexibility. They hear about people being able to do 6-hour bike rides or 10-hour runs with only one sachet of coconut oil or one stick of pemmican. And then everybody thinks that, oh, that's now the goal. Like I'm going to go out on Saturday, I'm going to ride my bike for 10 hours and see how little food that I can eat. And it's not really the goal. It's just kind of a barometer. Do you know what I mean? And so by like trying to attempt it, it's like trying to shove the mercury down inside of a thermometer. Like, it's not really a goal. So I think you really got to watch out for that, is just because your hunger went away and you feel so much better, you shouldn't keep pursuing that to the nth degree, because in our experience, it leads to disaster.
It's important to recognize the two different groups there, though, right? Because
yeah, they are. Context is everything.
Yeah, context is super important. So when you're looking for somebody to be able to get to the point where they're not hungry all the time, where they're physically overeating, eating whatever is in front of them just to stay mood stable, that's what most of the people we're surrounded by, that's the state that they're in. But at that point, that ability to control appetite, or for appetite to just regulate itself, is super important. Then you get spontaneous reduction in calorie intake. But it's worth remembering that maybe some of the people who are listening to this, there's the risk of then under eating. But the people that Rob's talking to is in general a very different population, and that's the message that they need, and that's what they need, is just somebody to get their appetite under control. So
the people who are listening to this podcast, you need to worry about the under eating problem. But the people whom you're going to send to Rob's course, maybe not so
may
much.
They have a different set of issues to deal with. Yeah. And that's the constant challenge, is keeping people flexible enough with that we've got different tools, different contexts, and we need to be able to shift that around. And it's not easy to get people to do that, either on the coaching side or on the kind of client side.
It's difficult because everybody wants one answer, right? I mean, still, like, no matter how intelligent or engaged, or everybody just wants to just tell me what to do, this is the one answer, this will be the answer forever. And then it's because it's just you do all this stuff, you feel great, and then you figure out you actually have to fix something else or do something different.
I have to admit, I was in a mild depressive state when you guys were finally like, yeah, okay, for glycolytic work you got to eat some carbs, because I was like, those guys will figure it out and then I'll just follow what they're doing and I'll fight. And then
the same thing happened to Chris, actually. So when Chris and I first started interacting, and he was talking about cyclocross and talking about his diet, I'm like, Chris, maybe you could just eat a few carbs and it would actually help. And he pushed back forever, but then also heard it from Mike T. Nelson and somebody else, and then finally did it. And they're like, oh yeah, actually, maybe this is a good idea.
Bad. Yeah. It's funny though, when you're sick though, you don't want to get sick again.
Yeah.
Motivator. Yeah. It was amazing how much benefit I got just from adding in a relatively small amount of carbohydrate into my diet. It brought that fifth gear right back. And we've interviewed a bunch of top athletes, Jeremy Powers, Katie Compton. They all said the same thing, that the diet is phenomenal for cognition. It's a really useful tool for me to maintain my body composition in the off season. But when it comes to game time, I got to have some carbs, man.
Right.
Also, I just can't hang with the competition. And this is how I make my money. And so, it's really not an option during the season. And it was a surprisingly small amount of carbohydrates as well. I mean, I measured my blood ketones just randomly. I got one of those new Keto Mojo meters.
Oh, nice.
And I tried it for the first time. It said 1.1 millimole first thing in the morning. I'm like, oh, shit. I guess that's still probably a ketogenic diet.
So that's the thing. You're still eating carbohydrate and that's relative to the intensity of the work that you do. And then you still manage to maintain periods of ketosis. That's exactly what we should be aiming for.
Right.
Yeah. And I do feel like that's where I've been with this. This whole podcast has been about me discovering all these different levers that you can pull. It's almost as if somebody pushed an untrained guy into the cockpit of an airplane. And the first lever I tried was the one that pulled the aircrane up from the ground, right? That was the diet lever. And then I'm just like playing around with all these other things. And yeah, so important to understand that there's more than one way to skin a cat, and it's all so complicated.
Yeah, and I guess we would call ourselves health educators or whatever you want to call it. It's just, for me, it's a constant struggle between, again, keeping that generalized approach, but then not allowing people to turn it into religious dogma, like the desire to like carve it into stone and leave no opportunity for nuance and discussion is incredible. It's super powerful in people.
Yeah, definitely. Talk about what you get people to measure. So are you a fan of measuring blood ketones?
Not really. We go over how to do it in the course because I know people are going to do it. So we at least want them to do it right. But there's definitely been this tendency for people to chase ketones.
Right.
And it becomes a little bit of a dick measuring contest where it's like, oh, I got to like 4.4, you know, or whatever. Right. And well, how'd you do that? So much MCT that I had to wear a diaper for 3 days. But, you know, my ketones got to this point. So we do provide kind of the guidelines for how to measure them and what the context would be. And usually it's in the beginning, just so that people can start getting a sense of, okay, my blood ketones are here, my blood glucose is here. What do I feel internally? How's my digestion? How's my sleep? How long can I go between meals? And so we use that as a little bit of a benchmark, kind of the first couple of weeks, so that there's an outside objective measure that people can look at and say, oh yeah, when that ketones are up a little bit, I feel pretty good. And so they get a little bit of feedback with that. But I really try not to have people chase the ketones, you know, chase the performance, chase the outcome, pick a goal, and then based off where you are and what the goal is, then we can figure out the diet, the lifestyle, the exercise plan that's going to get the person there. Mm. Yeah.
And do you not think that this might miss out on some opportunity for ketones as a signaling metabolite?
I don't know. And it's interesting. If the person is just exercising and they're eating a modest amount of carbohydrate, they're going to produce ketones. And so is that enough to get all the benefit of, you know, the signaling molecule kind of process? Is there a dose response curve with that? Is there a diminishing comparative return? So like there is a certain degree of myostatin inhibition. Like if you want to feel like you should be in ketosis all the time, you go hang with Ken Ford at the IHMC and then you're like, oh my God, I'm never eating carbohydrate again.
I was just there last week.
Oh my God. Yeah. The power is strong with that man. He's brilliant. And so it's everything from myostatin inhibition, the BDNF pathway is triggered by ketone signaling and whatnot. And so is simply eating kind of a modest degree of carbohydrate, being physically active, maybe eating within a time-restricted feeding window, is that enough? You know, to your point, you appear to still be producing some ketones at a decent clip. And so that may in fact be enough. And it's really interesting. And I mean, Megan's work looking at the potential longevity elements of this stuff, like that's really powerful and it's really compelling. But I have noticed that if people get too geeked out on the quantification stuff, they just kind of
micro-focus.
Yeah, it's literally like people now with their iPhones and they can't just look at street signs and figure out, okay, that one crosses. Like if their phone goes down, they're screwed. Like they literally cannot navigate an urban environment right now. And I kind of feel like that people can get there where they so rely on those external cues or feedback medium that they just don't pay attention to what their bodies tell them.
That part of their brain starts to atrophy.
Yeah, I mean, it literally does. Yeah. But to your point, I mean, there could be some really compelling reasons to monitor those ketone bodies. I think the next 5 years will be really fascinating because we're going to get a much better sense of, okay, how often, how much do you need these signaling molecules, at what level? But even then, there's going to be epigenetic differences, you know, from one person to another and what have you. You'll have some people that are hyper responders to it and they get phenomenal myostatin inhibition with comparatively low levels. Other people will have sky high levels and it doesn't inhibit the myostatin gene at all. And so there will be some shenanigans with that.
Have you got any thoughts on that, Tommy? With your knowledge of biochemical physiology, would you expect there to be like a magic number beyond which lots of good things happen?
No, nothing in biology is like that. Absolutely not a single thing.
You've got U-curves, and then you've got population distributions, and you've got some sort of weird overlapping of those two things. Uh-huh.
So two bell-shaped curves that maybe offset in one way or another that we don't yet know, and you'll never get to a point where you can say that's the magic number.
Okay, and then continuing that idea then, do you think that it's possible that the signaling is happening through multiple mechanisms and you can get the keto mojo meter now and measure your blood beta hydroxybutyrate, but really these changes, they're happening through many, many different signaling molecules and we don't know them all yet. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, probably. So recently we discovered irecin, right, which is released in response to cold, released in response to extreme exercise. And some people think that that's one of the key signaling molecules to do with mitochondrial uncoupling and metabolic health and all that kind of stuff. And then a whole other group of researchers did the same research again. And they were like, well, this thing exists, but it doesn't really seem to do very much. So, you know, we're still at the point where we're learning new molecules, and we still, you know, one day they're the thing that controls everything, and then the next day we're like, well, we don't really know if that's the case. So I think that's probably going to continue for a long period of time. And when it comes to the ketones, obviously beta hydroxybutyrate is the thing that we focus on. We don't know what the other peripheral mechanisms associated with that are. We don't know. I mean, almost anything that seems to have a beneficial effect in biology does a whole load of stuff at the same time, because anytime you try and do one targeted intervention with one drug that targets one pathway, it never fucking works. Like that
metformin works so well because it does so much.
And we still don't know all the things that it does. Right, exactly.
Right.
So I think that process of ketosis and going in and out of it and the metabolic pathways that you're activating, many of them are going to be tied to the ketone levels themselves, but many of them are going to be completely not tied to that. I think that's always going to be the case.
It's kind of an interesting aside. Some people who don't respond to conventional ketogenic diets for epilepsy, the acetone actually is the key signaling molecule for that process to work. And so they tinkered with giving these people antabuse, which inhibits the breakdown of the acetone, and you get a dramatic improvement in the, you know, the kind of therapeutic efficacy at a given ketone level. But
is that just because they're turning the acetone back to glucose and then they're just happy because they have high
I think it's levels? Actually something to do with the acetone modifying like calcium channel activity, but it really was the acetone that seemed to be the driver in that thing. But again, like I was just listening to a podcast you were on the way here, so it's funny. I'm kind of like, did I talk to him before? But where you were talking about, you know, like Cori cycle, the big importance of ketones under one circumstance is that it's providing Cori cycle intermediates to provide glucose for this other situation. And
so no optimal zone for ketones then?
There might be, but again, like
you're not advocating it.
I think at a minimum, sometimes dipping in and out sometimes, and maybe trying on that sweater occasionally. And that could be as ranging from time restricted feeding with a little bit of an eye towards the carbohydrate content. So maybe you front load carbohydrates in the day, and then later in the day you have fewer or none, and then you have a 16-hour fasting period. And so maybe we get a little bit of mild ketosis with that. Maybe at the end of that fasting period, you do some very low level cardio, like a walk or a little bit of exercise bike, just to kind of goose that stuff up.
I was thinking about that the other day, that how I was able to do that now. It's the first thing I do. It's become a little bit more challenging with the days being so short. But first thing in the morning, the first thing I do is go out and walk the dog, and quite often with my daughter. And back in 2012, I would have to get up in the middle of the night because I couldn't make it through the whole night without eating another bowl of cereal.
Right,
and it's so amazing to be able to do that and not feel like you're going to have to eat somebody's arm halfway through.
Right. I think this is quite reminiscent of Art Devaney's type approach, which is pretty stochastic, right? So sometimes you'll have dinner earlier, sometimes later, sometimes you'll skip breakfast, sometimes there'll be an intense workout in the morning, and then these things are going to be fluctuating. You're going to come in and out of ketosis.
Cycles.
You're going to, and it's just going to, I think in the environment that we live in, you almost have to build that in, right? It doesn't happen naturally anymore. So you have to almost mimic those patterns that we would have been exposed to in terms of carbohydrate intake, calorie intake, activity. So we almost have to create those cycles again unnaturally, if you want to call it that, because it's not something that we're going to be exposed to otherwise. But anything that sort of mimics those fluctuations is probably going to get you most of the way there, right?
What else are you getting people to track? So let's say I have a fat loss goal. Would you have me weigh my body mass?
At the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you hide your scale or give it to the neighbor or something like that. And we recommend monthly check-ins at the earliest. People just get so wrapped around the axle of seeing that scale move. And sometimes it goes exactly the way that we would hope, but ideally, folks are starting to lift more weights, whether it's just calisthenics or just generally being more physically active. Oftentimes, they just start eating more protein on a ketogenic diet, even though a ketogenic diet isn't necessarily like high protein, but they're comparatively eating more. And all of a sudden, they start accreting lean body mass, bone mineral density and everything. And so if that scale shift isn't ideal, they forget that their tight pants test, which is one of the things we recommend, is find a pair of pants that you're kind of like, man, I might pop a button getting into these. Try them on once a week. And photographs, tight pants test, I really like those. And and then I really, really like having some performance benchmark or a couple of different performance benchmarks, whether it's walking a quarter mile loop to go get your mail and you set your timer and you try to do it a little bit faster. You know, every couple of days, you try to shave some time off on that. And that's some of the power of CrossFit type interventions, where you're quantifying the work output in some manner, and you've got a goal that's performance oriented. One thing that I'll really give props to the kind of CrossFit methodology, I never saw disordered eating in that scene, because everybody wanted another pull-up. They wanted another 20 pounds on their clean and jerk or whatever. You know, and if somebody did, we had a couple of folks that they would show up and their performance from one day to the next in the gym had tanked. And I'm like, what's up? They're like, and then a little digging. It's like, well, I had some eating disorders. I didn't eat today, or maybe I binged and purged or whatever. I'm like, hey, do you see where you're at on the whiteboard there? You're last.
Right.
And the only way you're going to be first is you need to fucking eat.
Yeah.
And then they're like, bam. And so there's some real beauty to that, in a way that that performance orientation can really goose the process. Now, clearly it can become neurotic and everybody thinks they're going to be a CrossFit Games champion. And so this is, again, where there's like some sort of a diminishing returns. But for a lot of people that have been maybe sedentary and they're trying to figure out how to find a why, that finding that performance orientation can be really powerful and empowering at the same time. Yeah,
working with athletes, I've come to realize from spending a lot of time talking to Simon Marshall, is the only way to work with athletes. You can't talk to a woman and say, look, this low estradiol is eventually going to lead to a stress fracture. It's just about, or is it going to get you the time that you want
right
when you do this race next month?
Right.
That is the only thing. And I think it's the same with every sport. I don't care whether you are a ballet dancer or a tennis player or an ice hockey. It always has to be about performance.
Right.
If the goal is behavior change.
Right.
I was talking to my friend Paul Latoy. Paul has a fantastic app called Sensor.us.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, you might have seen it. It is designed and branded at the moment specifically for keto. And I think he's doing food logging better than any other application that I've seen. But I'm not really supposed to be talking about this yet because I'm not sure he's quite ready. He says he's got 40,000 users, but he's still not ready. One of the things he mentioned was that he thinks that people are inspired when they see that early weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you've been eating a high carbohydrate diet. You start the ketogenic diet and then initially you use some water with the glycogen. And so you see that change on the scale and you're like, oh my God, it's working. You know, like, do you think you're missing out on that?
Or I don't, because then immediately on the heels of that amazing weight loss grinds to a halt. Okay. And there's something in, you might remember the term, but there's something in human evolutionary psychology where we are more loss averse than gain motivated. You see it in primates. And so like, it's literally the, you know, a bird in hand is worth two in the bush kind of gig. And so if we're gaining something, then if that gain slows down, we have a perceived loss. Mm. And so I would argue quite the contrary, and I could be wrong, but that's where I kind of just want people to focus on some things like the tight pants test, some performance metrics, sleep, photographs, just because, man, I have seen so many people get super neurotic on the weight loss. And the weight loss is really dramatic in the beginning because of that kind of diuretic effect and what have you. But then when it grinds to a halt, and if you've got muscle mass gain occurring in conjunction with that, you can have somebody gain weight, you know, and then they just completely lose their mind. So yeah, personally, I would steer clear of that. Like, he may have some deeper insight into it, and I'll be happy to be proven wrong on that at some point. But my gut sense is to try to steer people away from the really consistent scale measurements. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that always brings me back to Jason Sibes' famous quote of, nobody cares about the force exerted by your body on the earth due to gravity, right? I mean, in reality, it means so little. I mean, society is kind of driven to focus on that, but anything you can do to get people to focus on something that means a lot more, even how their pants fit, like, that's telling you so much more about your body composition than a number on a scale. So I'd agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So if we're not measuring our body weight, what about caloric deficits? Are you insistent? Let's say I'm still the same person that has a weight loss goal. Do you think it's essential that I maintain a caloric deficit?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have to. It doesn't need to be super severe, although some things like a protein-sparing modified fast, holy smokes, those things are effective.
Could you
usually
give people some guidelines for that?
Those
who haven't heard of it.
Yeah, the protein-sparing modified fast has been used clinically in medical settings, and they oftentimes use some sort of like a proprietary shake, but it's basically very high protein, decent amount of fiber, low carb, low fat. And so you're getting a significant amount of satiety because of that high protein intake, but you have a really large caloric deficit even without exercise. Mm. Usually you don't motor along on this for an extended period of time. Depends on how much excess body fat that an individual has, but figure competitors and just some people who are very physique oriented will use something like a protein sparing modified fast, where for 3-4 days, they do 3 or 4 meals a day, as much lean protein. I mean, they're doing things like tuna and chicken breasts and stuff like that, egg whites, and then a bunch of veggies, fibrous, multicolored veggies. But you want as severe a caloric deficit as you can get with as much protein as you can so that you're not starving and wanting to eat your own arm off. But you can get a remarkable body fat reduction rather quickly by doing that. And interestingly, the protein is not turning into chocolate cake during the process, you know? And so, but beyond that, I think a more modest approach to this is, again, using a good calculator like what the Keto Gains guys have, where you've got a modest caloric deficit. It's 500, 600 calories per day. That will vary based off how large you are and your physical activity and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Again, I think that some of the things that can get confusing around this is it is easy to undereat on a low-carb or ketogenic diet.
Right.
And for the first time in one's life, you're not tied to the food. And so then this suggestion that calories don't matter really seems to be true. And in a way, it doesn't, because you just spontaneously don't overeat.
Right.
But then if you figure out a way to overeat, then it's going to be a problem. So, you know, it's interesting. People get really, I don't know, like some people are lumpers, some people are splitters. I'm kind of a lumper and like I see everything connected and it's all groovy, man, and everything. And so even when somebody, they say, well, the calories don't matter on low carb, I'm kind of like, yeah, you're right. Because you tend to spontaneously reduce calorie intake, and so it's super easy. And then the other person says, but hey, wait a minute, people overeat on that, like bulletproof coffee. I'm like, you're right, you got to pay a little bit of attention. And so you know, it's like all of that stuff is true. It just ends up kind of boiling down to context, you
right.
know. Yeah,
from what you've seen, how much of that spontaneous reduction in caloric intake is associated with macronutrient shifts, and how much is associated with just an improvement in diet quality? Because we would always argue diet quality before you worry about quantity, right? So I guess when you first started working paleo, it's much less macro-oriented, right?
Right.
You know, it's a quality thing. So you obviously, I assume you saw some of that happening spontaneous anyway. So do you have an idea of how those two contribute?
Man, that's a really good question, and I will not have a really good answer. One thing that I would throw out there in favor of this kind of ketogenic state, and I don't know if it's because of it lends itself to easily tracking the total macros and the total caloric load and whatnot, but I have never seen so many 400-pound plus people get down to a normal body weight as what I've seen. I've just never anywhere, you know, and like again and again and again. And I've also heard a lot of people who had disordered eating of various flavors, that ketogenic state ended up being the thing that addressed what they had going on. So again, there's probably a context deal there where some people, maybe the macros end up being kind of the bigger driver, that we do want that ketogenic state. We want that high protein. We want the satiety signaling around the ketone bodies. And then there may be other folks that just that softer approach of just like, hey man, whether it's beans and rice and chicken and, you know, like whole unprocessed food, eat to satiety, don't add too many processed elements to it, and they're going to do amazing with that. What's your gut sense on that? I feel like that was a very paltry answer to a really phenomenal question.
I honestly don't have the answer in any way better than you do. And I think, I mean, the reason why I think it's an important question to ask is because if you look at clinical trials of diets broadly, you can get very similar weight loss regardless of the diet. And actually, I think the best trial-based dietary study in terms of weight loss over 3 to 12 months was actually a plant-based whole foods vegan diet, which requires you to eat a lot of carbohydrate and very small amounts of fat. So I just wonder if part of that hypothalamic appetite regulation comes from the inflammatory nature of just the general foods that we're eating.
And sure.
However you can get rid of that, the two easiest ways to do it are whole food, plant-based, vegan, or ketogenic.
And, you know, to your point, like if you had somebody that was really suffering from endotoxemia, like LPS endotoxemia, maybe that super high fiber, low fat, vegan approach is going to be superior.
We definitely see it.
And that's what we've done. You know, some people depending on what's going on in their gut, some people do so well on keto, some people feel terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, yeah, every time I have my bulletproof coffee, I just feel foggy and terrible. And I just kind of, I just think I need to restrict carbs more, but we just go exactly the other way and they feel great.
So, right. Definitely. Right. That's kind of the cool opportunity that we have is we have these, if we didn't learn a single thing more about ketosis or metabolism or anything ever, and you know, if humanity went on for a million years, we didn't learn anything else, but we just got good at sorting people and then prescribing something that was appropriate for them based off of some rough sorting mechanisms, we would solve most of the issues that we have. Yeah. And that's kind of the cool opportunity is it's kind of like, okay, well, we tried this, so that's not working. And we're getting all these signs and symptoms of like endotoxemia. We're not getting the clearing up of brain fog. We're getting a worsening. So let's seal those tight junctions. Let's not provide these fats that can help piggyback the LPS through the gut and do this other intervention. So that's cool.
Just the drive to figure out, just to want there to be one answer. And if we can say, actually, there's 10 answers, and if we can implement all of them in the right person, that's going to get us so much closer.
Right.
That's the,
right.
Having those conversations between, everybody always has good ideas, but then they always want to.
Which that's a big step for you guys, because you guys are kind of known as being kind of like the keto performance folks. And so
it's
that's
very
a big
confusing,
deal.
Actually. If I was to listen to my podcast without doing my day job, you would think that if you're going to come to Nourish, Balance, Thrive, you're definitely going to get a ketogenic diet.
But right. It's almost never.
It's always that we spend more time trying to get people off of ketogenic diets.
Eat more carbs. Right.
But again, it's always comes down to who are you and what are your goals, right? You're a 110-pound female triathlete and I can see veins in your belly.
Right.
And you're getting stress fractures in your feet. And your estradiol's in your boots, like this is probably not the time for keto for you.
Right.
So maybe that's, I mean, it's obviously not who you're trying to talk to
right.
in this training course.
But inevitably, the funny thing is folks in that population, they want to get leaner, even though they're like Skeletor lean already.
Right.
And they see somebody go from 400 pounds to 185 pounds and they look amazing. So they're like, oh, I'll just do that. And it's like, that is not the direction you go at all.
It's, right
it's off season. It's when all these other things get addressed. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's wrap up here. So correct me if I'm wrong. It's a video training course. It's called the Keto Masterclass.
Keto Masterclass. It's a 45-day course, 13 video modules, a huge workbook that basically guides people every day through nutrition, exercise, sleep, mindset. I mean, it's really remarkably comprehensive. I did a pretty in-depth piece on keto and cholesterol, kind of talking about the different stories between lipoproteins and cholesterol. I'm actually pretty proud of it. Like, it's pretty solid material. And then we actually commissioned an epigeneticist to do an epigenetics piece to kind of talk about the potential of just any long-term change being able to literally rewrite who you are, you know, at kind of a molecular level. So those are a couple of several bonuses in the thing that I think are really phenomenal. But I mean, it handholds people through the process. We try to make it as intuitive and support intensive as possible.
And who's it for? So we already said that it was maybe for people who had knew nothing at all about the diet.
The person who knows nothing about the diet, but is maybe curious, definitely someone who is kind of known to have some metabolic issues, some insulin resistance, someone who's hit a plateau on keto.
Right.
But the thing is during the sorting process, it may not be more keto.
Yeah.
Part of right. the sorting may punt you someplace else. But even within that context, it's not that, oh, you need to do something else. If you're eating more carbs, it still guides you through the process in that
right.
higher carb intake. So the dreaded plateau, and then like navigating the social situations, then also like if you're just time pressured, like there's really some remarkable resources that help people get food generated in a more time efficient fashion. Like it's pretty slick.
Do you know what? I think this would be good for even the super users out there to have a look at the instruction manual. Have you ever gotten great results by taking some sort of gadget or some sort of process and you play around with it and you see how it works? And once you have a basic understanding of the way that it works, you then read the instruction manual.
Right.
And only then is the instruction manual interesting. And I wonder whether this might be interesting for our listeners in the same way, lest you be falling into some trap like I was, Steve Finney saying to me, oh, but you didn't eat salt. That's why it took you 2 years to keto adapt.
You know, part of my hesitation in recommending it to a super savvy crowd like you guys have is because oftentimes people go in and they want some, like, they want one of your graduate level biochemistry lectures.
Talk about oxaloacetate, Tommy.
And it's not that, but yeah. It is, like, I really tried, and this is part of it. You guys gave some great feedback on, hey, you should populate all of a day's
food input,
you know, so fully populating it instead of only a partial population. But we had a lot of people kick the tires on it. And I mean, I tried to not leave anything out of it. So to your point again, just the troubleshooting part of it, like if you run aground somewhere, the troubleshooting part of this thing could be worth the whole deal. Because like you were talking about, had you addressed the electrolytes early on, it might have been an 8-month keto adaptation instead of 2 years. And maybe a lot less downside for you, you know? So, yeah.
Absolutely.
But I have been nervous about, like, suggesting that the really geeked out keto folks do it because, you know, they're just like, there's nothing new in here. And it's like, there's nothing new, but there's everything in there, you know? So, I don't know.
So, here's the thing. And, you know, I'm finding this a lot personally. And I think our clients are finding the same is, there's all the information is out there. What I really need now is someone to curate that information.
And it definitely does the most important bits.
Like all the answers are there. It's just like, well, what matters for me at this time? That's the thing.
Right. And that's part of the reason why, too, I think the price is $49. Like we had some people from kind of the Ask Method scene. They're like, this should be a $500 course. And I was like, I think that's a little steep. And so we wanted it to be completely like people get it. They check it out. And they're like, I would have paid 4 or 5 times more for that. So like over deliver, under promise, you know, that whole deal. So, but we really tried to curate everything in it. And again, make it a soup to nuts program where when you start on day one, you know where you're going to be at day 20 and day 30 right. and moving your way through the whole thing. So
That's phenomenal. Well, yeah, good for you. I wish we'd done this honestly, because you know, we did the Keto Summit and we asked those people what they wanted, and they didn't want more talk about oxaloacetate. They just wanted a fucking instruction manual for the diet. You know?
Right. So they wanted the Keto Masterclass.
They wanted the Keto Masterclass. Yeah. And that's the number one really hard question that I get every day is, I really want to work with you guys, but I don't have $10,000. What have you got? And I'm like scratching my head going, I don't really know. And so, you know, to do a $50 thing is incredible. So congratulations
cool.
on that. We're really excited for you.
Yeah. So for the people that have been critical of the whole process, I've thrown out the following controversial position. Let's assess it based on its merits and weaknesses. And wherever the merits are, we'll play with those. And if there are weaknesses, I'll get in and address it. And then we'll go from there.
Oh, so really? That's so my gonna be greasy. Objective, there may be a version 2.0.
Absolutely. Yeah. And anybody that buys the first one, they're going to get all future updates on it. Yeah, for sure. Because as it is right now, I want to include those kind of mindset video modules so that like, hey, you want to talk to your parents. Like the parents are the first thing that I'm going to address because you have so many people that have older parents that are ill and they're trying to get them to modify their diet. And I'm just going to basically hold up a picture of my mom and my daughter and say, my mom got to meet my daughter once and then she died and she died early and she didn't have to. And so I'm here talking to you because you've got a child who's tried to talk to you. And so I've got this whole thing kind of laid out and I'm really hoping that that provides a buffer. And so we're going to add all kinds of new stuff like that. And people are going to have lifetime access to that stuff. So
that's amazing. Where do people find it?
Let's see here. robwolf.com/NBT.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I will, of course, link to that in the show notes for this.
And that's
episode.
The assuming Nikki has finished that link by now, but I'm pretty sure that will be a good link. So we'll make it the good link at this point.
Excellent. Awesome. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about, Rob?
Just huge thank you. Like, I am so indebted to the work that you guys do, and I am so incredibly tickled that I had any influence in the work that you're doing. Like, you guys, a couple of folks like you, Marty Kendall, like, you guys have really picked up the torch in this next iteration of kind of integrating this nutrition and lifestyle for optimized living, and have just taken it to amazing places, somewhere I would have never been able to take it in a million years. So I'm so honored to have played any role in this stuff. Thank you.
Oh, you played a huge one, and thank you. Absolutely. And we'll continue to, I'm sure, as you are doing right now.
Yeah, I think we're all standing on the shoulders of giants here in a way, you know, like, and you can really notice when you've got someone who's clearly brilliant, but they synthesize their information in a vacuum. And they're like, oh, you really need to listen to Ivor Cummings' presentations.
Right.
There's some important parts missing from your understanding. And exactly that kind of listening to what other people are doing, I think is very, very important. And yeah, thank you. It's a true honor for that. Thank you.
Thank you.